sheriff and school board positions.
Those are really important because they're going to be first line of defense against immigration policy, against cutting a federal education department. And so I think hopeful for two reasons. One, building the bench, and two, building local power now.
While female representation on Capitol Hill diminished slightly compared to last year, Haynes says that isn't the case for states like Nevada. It's one of three states where more than half of its legislators are women, according to the Center for American Women in Politics. Haynes adds that it's too early to know what exactly motivated the more than 12,000 folks nationwide, but it's something his organization will keep an eye on. If you're interested in learning more about running for state or local office, you can visit runforwhat.net. Haynes says his organization will continue to get more people of diverse backgrounds and lived experiences to run for office. He says they not only help guide folks along the way, but they also help them determine the best office to run for. He says prep work is crucial.
The Run for Something alums are, they ran initially to try and solve some problem in their community. And so we are always looking for that, looking for like what really motivates people to get into the race, what office they're looking to run for, if that office has the power to solve the problem that they're trying to solve.
Haynes acknowledges that for many, November's election results were anything but ideal. But he says change takes time, and that's something he and others are working towards.
Have people in Congress who are Run for Something alumni. That is hope. That is like medium-term hope, right? It takes years and election cycles for that to happen.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 9th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings and Josh Salem. The producers Annette Newell and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories.
On Musk's dangerous interventions in European politics. Trump's imperial ambitions, take over the Panama Canal, buy Greenland, incorporate Canada. And the author of A Problem from Hell, now a prominent U.S. official, talks about Gaza. First, Elon Musk's dangerous interventions in European politics. Musk is not yet second president of the United States, but he is already playing the role of power broker in European politics. Germany's and Britain's, for starters, by siding with far-right parties and politicians in ways that suggest more than mere flirtation with neo-Nazi ideas. In Germany, the collapse of the Scholz government means that new elections will take place in February. The far-right, neo-Nazi-supported AfD party is running second in popularity, though other parties will not coalition with it in the elections. Musk has intervened, saying on X, quote, "Only the AfD can save Germany." A few days later, he called Scholz an incompetent fool and said he should resign following the death of two people when a car slammed into a crowd of Christmas shoppers in the city of Magdeburg. On December 28th, Musk reaffirmed support for AfD in an opinion piece for the German newspaper Welt am Sonntag. Musk accused Germany's traditional political parties of becoming, quote, "comfortable with mediocrity, including economic decline." writing that, quote, the AfD can save Germany from becoming a shadow of its former self. Not content to stop there, Musk plans to hold an online audio discussion on X with Alice Weidel, a leader of AfD and the party's candidate for chancellor. MSN reports that several German government officials have denounced Musk's attempt to sway German voters. A government spokesperson based in Berlin said, quote, it is indeed the case that Elon Musk is trying to influence the federal election. Musk was free to express his opinion, the spokesperson added, quote, after all, freedom of opinion also covers the greatest nonsense. Schulz has simply said, don't feed the troll. France's Emmanuel Macron adds, quote, 10 years ago, who would have imagined that the owner of one of the world's largest social networks would be supporting a new international reactionary movement and intervening directly in elections, including in Germany? In British politics, Musk in the last few days withdrew support of Nigel Farage, head of the far-right Reform UK party, saying Farage, quote, doesn't have what it takes to lead. Just like that, another MP became Musk's favorite, revealing how capricious it can be to seek Musk's favor. Musk has also posed as a protector of children's rights in Britain, claiming that Prime Minister Keir Starmer was, quote, complicit in the rape of Britain and should face charges for his actions when he was the country's chief prosecutor. That drew a riposte from Britain's health secretary, who said, quote, if he, Musk, wants to roll up his sleeves and actually do something about tackling violence against women and girls, then online platforms, whether X or any of the other platforms, have got a role to play in keeping people safe. Does Musk speak for Trump when he intercedes in other countries' internal affairs? Since he's not a U.S. official, he can't be held accountable for his actions by anyone except Trump. Musk has access to anyone, anywhere. Does Trump or anyone on his team care about Musk's online comments and the way he dispenses his money? They should. Musk runs a global business that creates an obvious conflict of interest, and he has a top-secret security clearance while being exposed to state secrets on military technology. He may, like Trump, with the Russians, play fast and loose with those secrets. Next, Trump's imperial ambitions. Still only president-elect, Donald Trump is already lobbing threats at friendly governments. He has renewed calls he made in his first term to take over the Panama Canal and acquire Greenland. At a rally in Arizona, Trump called for a major decrease in the fees Panama charges for use of its canal. Otherwise, he said, the U.S. might seize it. He noted that the United States built the canal in the early 1900s and called Panama's fees ridiculous, a complete ripoff, and a disgrace. If the situation didn't change, Trump said, we will demand that the Panama Canal be returned to the United States in full, quickly, and without questions. So to the officials of Panama, please be guided accordingly, unquote. At his January 7 news conference, Trump did not rule out the use of force to acquire the canal. Panama's president, José Raúl Mulino, reminded Trump that a 1977 treaty in the Jimmy Carter years restored sovereignty over the canal to his country. Every square meter of the Panama Canal and the surrounding area belongs to Panama and will remain that way, he said. China stepped in with a supportive comment. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Mao Ning referred to Mulino's statement and said there is no control, direct or indirect, from any power over the canal, contrary to what Trump is charging. China will, as always, respect Panama's sovereignty over the canal, said the spokesperson. Trump followed up on his Panama fantasy with this demand on Greenland, quote, for purposes of national security and freedom throughout the world, the United States feels that the ownership and control of Greenland is an absolute necessity, unquote. The comment received the same kind of response made by Panama's leader. Greenland's head of government, Mote Burup Ejid, said, quote, Greenland is ours. We are not for sale and will never be for sale. We must not lose our years-long fight for freedom. In a New Year's speech, Ejid proposed an alternative. Greenland should seek independence from Denmark. The history and current conditions have shown that our cooperation with the Kingdom of Denmark has not succeeded in creating full equality, said Ejid, who is a member of the pro-independence Community of the People Party. Since 2009, Greenland has had the right to vote by referendum on the independence issue and might do so as early as April. At his January 7 news conference, Trump threatened that he would, quote, tariff Denmark at a very high level if it does not give Greenland to the United States. Then there's Trump's intervention in Canada's political problems. Trump has demanded that Canada, like Mexico, do more to stifle the border drug trade. In fact, a minuscule amount of fentanyl and illegal immigration crosses the border with Canada. Yet Trump said, quote, Canadians want Canada to become the 51st state, and called then-Prime Minister Justin Trudeau a governor. One prominent Canadian official said his country should retaliate by stopping energy exports to the United States, though that position doesn't seem to have much support. Trudeau, deeply unpopular among voters and in his own Liberal Party, has just stepped down. On March 26, Canada will have a new leader to deal with Trump. That didn't stop Trump's posturing. He wrote on Truth Social, quote, if Canada merged with the U.S., there would be no tariffs, taxes would go way down, and they would be totally secure from the threat of the Russian and Chinese ships that are constantly surrounding them. Together, what a great nation it would be, and three exclamation points. At his January 7 news conference, Trump threatened he would use economic force to join Canada and the United States together. Close observers of Trump's behavior say his aim is to gain leverage for deals that don't involve takeovers, but do give in to U.S. pressure to change existing search situations. On Panama, that might mean lower canal transit fees. Greater access to Greenland's rare earth deposits might be behind that purchase offer. As for Canada, well, it's so close and they love us, so it might as well be ours. These interpretations may be correct, but it is looking all the more possible that Trump truly means to recapture the imperial spirit of a century ago, adding countries to U.S. territory and to Trump's legacy. Suffice to say, this man is a megalomaniac and a clear and present danger to peace. The author of A Problem from Hell talks about Gaza. Samantha Power, author of that 2002 book on genocide and now administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, could find little to say about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza when reminded about what she had advocated as an author when, quote, the United States has the power to stop the killing at a reasonable risk, it has the duty to act, unquote. Interviewed at a forum, she shied away from blaming anyone for failing to act in Gaza, nor would she say why, contrary to her writing, she has not resigned in protest. All she could point to was small efforts in humanitarian aid. Small indeed, she said, maybe next to the scale of suffering going on. Samantha Power should know better. In its latest report, Human Rights Watch concludes, quote, Israeli authorities have deliberately inflicted conditions of life calculated to bring about the destruction of part of the population in Gaza by intentionally depriving Palestinian citizens there of adequate access to water, most likely resulting in thousands of deaths. Second, in doing so, Israeli authorities are responsible for the crime against humanity of extermination and for acts of genocide. Amnesty International has also accused Israel of genocide in Gaza, and the World Health Organization's director has condemned Israel's raid on Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, where it detained 240 Palestinians. The director of WHO issued an anguished plea, quote, we repeat, stop attacks on hospitals. People in Gaza need access to health care. Humanitarians need access to provide health aid. Cease fire. Finally, Human Rights Watch also said governments and international organizations should take all measures to prevent genocide in Gaza, including discontinuing military assistance, reviewing bilateral agreements and diplomatic relations with Israel, and supporting the International Criminal Court and other accountability efforts. The U.S. response? Another $8 billion in arms for Israel announced by the State Department the other day. The arms package includes GPS guidance systems for 500-pound bombs. The deal will go through unless leaders of the four main congressional committees disapprove, or if two-thirds of both houses of Congress disapprove. In other news, Russia's bases in Syria. A few weeks ago, I reported that the Russians were packing their bags and beginning to move out of their four bases in Syria, including its only naval base on the Mediterranean at Tartus and its air base at Khmeimim. The Russians acquired those bases as rewards for their support of the Bashar al-Assad regime in 2015, when they bombed many of the same people who are now in power. Despite killing thousands of Syrians in the civil war, the Russians apparently are in negotiation with the new regime to keep some of their military assets in country in return for humanitarian and economic aid. This is a story I'll be following. Next, the carbon removal industry. Is it another high-priced scam? The removal and storage of carbon in the atmosphere is becoming the new darling of big-time investors and major corporations. They're betting that sometime in the future, the technology being developed by numerous companies will be able to scrape enough carbon to essentially solve the climate crisis. Investors have already poured billions into these efforts, and the Biden administration has given them substantial subsidies. Will carbon scraping work, or is it another attempt at a technological fix to a problem like other geoengineering ideas that should be addressed at its source, namely fossil fuel production and use? Investors are buying up credits in the belief that at some uncertain time in the future, the technology will work. But critics make some important points. First, by the time the technology works, it will be far too late to save us from the ravages of climate change. And second, that carbon scraping lets everyone, starting with the oil and gas industry, off the hook, giving license to continue polluting the atmosphere. A Stanford University civil and environmental engineer goes further, saying, quote, "Carbon capture will increase fossil fuel production. There's no doubt about it. It does not help climate one bit." Or, as former Vice President Al Gore succinctly puts it, quote, "We need to obey the first law of holes. When you're in one, stop digging." But those words are not going to stop Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Boeing, and the rest from seeking to make a profit from carbon scraping. Finally, two updates. In Romania, lawmakers voted narrowly in favor of a new pro-European Union coalition government led by incumbent Prime Minister Marcel Cialacu. The move may end a protracted political crisis in which a top court annulled a previous presidential election on the basis of intelligence indicating a Russian influence operation that made a far-right unknown the front-runner. Parliament approved the new administration in a 240 to 143 vote in Romania's 466-seat legislature. And in South Korea, politics remains chaotic. The National Assembly, having impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol on December 14, voted to impeach his interim successor, Han Duck-soo. Han had refused to appoint three judges to vacancies on the 9-member Constitutional Court. Six of the nine must rule to convict Yoon and bring about his removal from office. The current finance minister is now the acting president. Prosecutors were unsuccessful in trying to detain Yoon at his compound, where he has been protected by his security service. He remains suspended from office. And while this drama plays out, the South Korean economy is being hit hard with a dramatic fall in the value of the won, among other things. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. The largest nurses strike in Oregon history is set to start tomorrow, as Providence nurses and even some doctors plan to walk off the job at 6 a.m. Last week on Labor Radio, KBOO's Jamie Partridge and Laura Wadlin interviewed two Providence nurses and Oregon Nurses Association members, Richard Botterill and Kim Martin, to learn more about the strike.
Please give us a blow-by-blow of what's been happening in the struggle with Oregon's largest healthcare provider, and what is the importance of lining up contract expiration dates at a number of Providence facilities?
So yeah, this has been going on ever since the last time we talked to you, and when we went out on strike, or almost 2 years ago now, a year and a half ago, and this has been accentuated when House Bill 2697 came into law, the safe staffing bill for healthcare workers. And the issues that we're dealing with, there's four major. Safe staffing, obviously, is the big one. We have paid time off, also used for sick time in our world. We have our healthcare, which I'm probably going to talk about later. And we have wages. Now, some of our hospitals have been at the table negotiating with Providence for more than 15 months. And during that time, for the last year, in fact, those same hospitals have actually been working without a contract for the last 12 months. So they're some of the big issues that we're looking at right now. And as you mentioned, now we have 8 hospitals, and all of the nurses at those 8 hospitals have authorized a strike through a strike authorization vote. The hospitalists and the OBGYN docs and other folks at the women's clinics have also authorized a strike, and they are both working on their initial contracts. The rest of us are all looking at a continuation of contracts that already exist.
I would say Providence nurses have been experiencing takeaways and benefits and support to do the job the public deserves over the last decade at least. And this is not having to cut worker benefits because times are tight. This is about choosing other priorities. Providence is a quote-unquote nonprofit that is over a $30 billion corporation and then pays their executives millions of dollars. And they've made these cuts or gains by just standing still and really not just refusing to negotiate. And when these cuts mean there's less nurses, that means there's understaffing. That means when a confused or scared patient needs comforting, they may need to wait longer. That means when someone's painful, they may need to wait longer to get attention, or worse things could happen. And when that happens, nurses suffer moral injury. They get burned out. And we're at a point now, some nurses are ready to get bold and demand better. And that's why all of the bargaining units in Oregon have authorized a strike authorization vote by a majority.
And I think the majority of nurses are very aware, the majority of healthcare workers are very aware of the repercussions of the privatization or the institutionalization of healthcare. It's being corporatized now. And I think that there are people running healthcare across the country. It's not just, we're not unique in this, to where you think you can run a healthcare organization the same as you can run any other organization, whether it's in a car manufacturing or whatever else it might be. And that's not the case. And I think that's one of the problems that we're running into now, is that corporatization of the healthcare community. It's detrimental to the people that work in that world, and it's certainly detrimental to the communities that we serve.
So over the past few years, we've seen a surge of hospitals getting bought up by private equity firms, meaning basically investors trying to make more money. What's been the impact of this trend on patients and healthcare workers?
You know, this is a growing and disturbing trend because these groups are trying to make a profit, not invest in staff, not invest in safe patient conditions. And there is peer-reviewed research out there that shows an increase in hospital-acquired conditions like falls and bloodstream infections. And this is not the mission the sisters envisioned for Providence patients. But it has left some of their choices left some of us pondering and speculating that maybe Providence is trying to get themselves into position for a move like this.
I think another example of that is, I think there are some of the clinics now, it used to be that the healthcare workers were required to see 24 patients in a shift. And my understanding is that now that number has been increased to 36. And I don't think it's difficult to see how that is detrimental to patient care.
I wonder if that's why recently several units of providers like nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and medical doctors have organized and joined ONA. What's the significance of those units unionizing? And how are those providers involved in the current contract campaign?
You know, I think it just underlines, when it's just all the nurses, it's one thing when one or two hospitals are going and talking about strike, are trying to get to the table, are trying to negotiate in a fair way to get a contract that's reasonable and rational. That's one thing. Then it expands to where all of the hospitals in the state of Oregon that are Providence hospitals are all saying the same thing, are all at the table, are all asking for the same improvements and the same changes within their contracts and within their work environment. But at that point, it's still, well, it's just the nurses. Well, now we have doctors and other healthcare providers across the board coming out and saying the same things. So I think that, I think going back to what we were just talking about with the corporatization, I think that that kind of just underlines that this is a serious problem that we're facing. And again, it's not just Providence, but we are Providence. We're the people of Providence. And that's the organization that right now is standing up and saying, wait a minute. You know, we need to change how we're managing. We need to change how we're functioning and working as a healthcare organization for the sake of, not just the people working in that organization, but the people that come to us for care.
2023, the Oregon legislature passed a safe staffing law for healthcare settings, HB 2697. What's your view on the law? And have conditions changed at all since it was passed?
I have mixed feelings. When the law first came into place, one of the first things when I read through it is identifying all of the loopholes that have been placed in that law. Obviously, it was a law that was negotiated between management as well as healthcare workers and unions. So there's a lot of people involved in that. So I, first of all, noticed all of the loopholes and thought, oh, well, that's a way to soften it a little bit. Here's another way to soften it a little bit. Now, I think it has helped in that some of the other pieces of the law are very solid in terms of looking at ratios. How many patients can a nurse have? I think it's positive in looking at ensuring that nurses and healthcare workers get their breaks. I think it's important in looking at what constitutes safe staffing within any unit within the hospital. So there's the positives. Unfortunately, in our discussions, what we found is Providence's position and interpretation of the law differs from the nurses' interpretation of the law. Our position is you're misinterpreting the law. Their position is, no, we're just interpreting it in a different way. To my mind, what was very clear is at one of our negotiating sessions several weeks ago now, the corporate attorney came out and basically gave us his version of a rewrite of our staffing article within our contract. And at that point, I pointed out and I said, you know, it looks like what you've done here is you've tried to rewrite the contract in a way to get around all of the issues in the law that you don't like. And to his credit, he acknowledged that that was exactly what he'd done. So, you know, there is a positive to that. We're still discussing differences of opinion on how the law is to be interpreted. I think that now our staffing committee, and Kim is also a member, a powerful member of our staffing committee at Providence Portland. Fortunately, we have a very solid staffing committee who are the people that are, through the law, the people that approve staffing contracts, if you like, with each of the units around our hospital. So that's a process that's continuing, and I would actually defer to Kim to talk more about that because I think she's closer to it and knows a lot more than I do about the inner workings of staffing committee.
Yeah, I would. The law does a few things, but one of the things it does is it puts a stop sign, a limit on the number of patients a nurse can have care for at one time. And as Richard said, I'm on the staffing committee at our hospital, which is supposed to, as is required by law, approves safe staffing plans for nursing units. Management has made it clear to us since the law passed that they just have no appetite to pass any mutually agreed on plans. They want to default to the maximum number of patients a nurse can have as prescribed in the setting without regard to acuity factors that may make that maximum number not appropriate. They also say that maximum is a mandate It's not a maximum, it's a mandate. You must have those many patients. So they want to put their distorted version of the law, some wording into our contract, which for me is just an absolute no-go. For me personally, that is a strike issue, nothing I can abide by. I think we'll have to continue working on settling our differences on the meaning of the law, but we want to pass safe staff. The staff nurses want to pass real nursing plans with acuity factors, and that is a job for the nurses that care for patients. This is not a job for hospital attorneys.
That was an excerpt from Labor Radio, hosted by KBOO's own Jamie Partridge and Laura Wadlin. They interviewed two Oregon Nurses Association members, Richard Botterill and Kim Martin, about the Providence Nurses Strike, scheduled to begin on Friday, January 10th. It will be the largest nurses strike in Oregon history. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO